Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hello, Max. What have you got for us today?
This week on the show is an episode of our show, which is also an episode of another show.
Are you saying this is a crossover event?
Crossover episode. If we had an air horn, this is where someone would play the air horn. You guys know I am hosting another podcast. It's called 70 Over 70. It launched in May. I'm talking to 70 remarkable people, all of them over the age of 70. I've already talked to Dionne Warwick and Norman Lear, all kinds of incredible people. But this week on 70 is Dan Rather. And I thought, you know, Dan Rather, that's interesting to our people here on the Longform Podcast, too. So crossover episode, Dan Rather's in two places at once.
Works for everyone.
What is Dan Rather up to now?
Well, for the young people who are listening, who might not remember this time, Dan Rather was the anchor of the CBS Evening News for like 25 years. And we talked a lot about that time in media. There was three TV networks. He was talking to like tens of millions of people a night, but also just what it was like for him to be in that role. He described it as a NASA-grade fuel for your ego. And so we talked about like that thing. And then we also talked about how it ended. And some people listening might remember Rather was accused of sort of being duped by forged documents. His time at CBS News ended quite unceremoniously. And we talked about that too, and particularly like what that experience was like for him. But now, Aaron, to answer your question, he's like an independent journalist. He's living in Texas. He's writing books. He's got a, wait for it, Substack. And he's doing his thing.
I almost stepped on your factual statement by making the exact joke that is apparently not a joke. I did not know that. He has a Substack. That's real.
He has a Substack and he's out like doing journalism. And that was part of what was interesting talking to him too, is like he was in this position where he was talking to like a third of the country every night. And now he's a freelance journalist doing the stories he wants to do. And so we talked about that too.
Dan Rather, he's just like us now.
Well, if he was like us, he would be doing his newsletter with MailChimp. They make it easy and they're our sponsor. So I would hope that anyone who wants to start an independent journalism career like Dan Rather's would go the MailChimp route. I have used their products for many years and always been delighted. Thanks, MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Dan Rather.
Dan Rather, this is crazy that I'm interviewing you. I've listened to like hundreds and hundreds of interviews you've done. This is exciting for me.
I'm honored to be on with you and thank you.
I'd really like to talk to you about your life right now and about the work you're doing right now because I'm fascinated by it. But I was wondering if we could start by going back. There's a time in your professional life where it seems like you were almost plucked from obscurity and put in this really prominent national spotlight as a reporter and as a news anchor. It seems like it happened really quickly. Did it feel that way to you? Or do I have the story wrong?
Well, the short answer is yes, it did appear that way to me at the time. I had always dreamed of being a reporter, and I considered myself very lucky that I was indeed able to get jobs as a journalist, you know, coming out of college. You know, I was the anchor at a television station in Houston, KHOU, which was a CBS affiliate, which was by far the best job I'd had. I'd flunked out of being a newspaper man, to tell you the truth. I was a very bad speller. By the time 1961 came around, I was the director of news and community affairs. Basically, I was the director of myself. But at any rate, a great hurricane came, a hurricane that is still, I think, on record, the largest hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico.
Carla, right?
Hurricane Carla, September 1961. Because I grew up in hurricane country on the Texas coast, I knew about hurricanes, and I'd covered hurricanes before. It turned out to be I was the right person in the right time, doing some of the right things, and we were able to do live coverage, which was, at the time, unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And CBS National picked up some of our coverage.
And that had a real impact on people, right? I mean, it was the first time that people sitting at home could see where the hurricane was in relation to their house geographically, and it got people out of there, right?
Well, exactly. This is where, keep in mind that nobody on television was using radar for weather. Nobody. And radar was only beginning to be used even by the National Weather Service. But they had a radar installation in Galveston, one of the few in the country. So what happened was a breakthrough on television, although I didn't realize it at the time. We superimposed a map of the Texas coast over the radar picture of the hurricane, which showed people dramatically in a way that had never been done before, just how big the hurricane was and what a great danger it was. And that resulted in a mass evacuation from the Texas coast, which at the time was the largest peacetime evacuation in the history of the country. You use the word pluck me from obscurity, but I think that's a fair description. They offered me a job with the network as a result of that hurricane coverage. It was my big break, let's face it.
What did that big break feel like for you?
It felt absolutely wonderful. It was a dream come true. This is CBS News in New York, and we want to talk to you about coming to work here. You what? But, you know, that quickly led to a very heavy dose of, first of all, gratitude, and secondly, for humility. Because when I got to New York, you know, I had been a journalist for more than 10 years. And without any conceit, I thought I was pretty good. I could report, I could write, I could handle myself on the air. But when I got to New York, let's face it, I walked the halls with legends. Severide, Collingwood, Ed Murrow had just left and was still around. Those names don't mean much now, but in my time, they were the absolute superstars of not just television news, but television. And I don't like to use a cliche, but minor league baseball players who are moved up to the major leagues sometimes marvel at how much better the pitching is. Curveballs break sharper, fastballs are faster. That was very much my sense of it when I got to New York and walked the halls at CBS, was boy, oh boy, this is a fast track.
To extend your metaphor for a second, did you feel like you could hit that pitching? Did you have confidence that you would get there? Or did you show up and feel like I'm not in the right place?
No, I had a sense that I definitely was in the right place. Frankly, and I hope this won't be seen as arrogant in any way, but I have to say, once up there, I felt it was my destiny. Keep in mind that when I was bedridden with rheumatic fever as a child, I heard these voices of CBS News on the radio by my bedside.
Right.
I had dreamed of it. Now, about can I hit the big league pitching? I always had confidence. I never had overconfidence. Maybe sometimes later in my career, but certainly then, it was a sense, yeah, I can do this, but I have really got to focus and I've got to be all in, was my feeling. I remember after the first day I was in New York and I met Severide, Collingwood, Murrow, that my reaction was, I'm a long way from being anywhere near their equal in ability and in talent, but I can do it, but I had to hurry. New York is not a place where you get second chances.
No one was going to wait for you to figure it out.
Well, it didn't take long for me to figure it out.
And how long was it before you ended up in the chair?
Well, let's see, I came to work at CBS News early in 1962. I took the chair as anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News from the iconic Walter Cronkite, March 9th, 1981. So it was basically 20 years.
And almost exactly 40 years ago.
That's right.
Does it feel like 40 years ago?
You know, some days it seems like 400 years ago. And other days it feels like just like yesterday.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Can you remember that first night, March 9th? Can you remember what it felt like?
Sure. Of course I remember it. I remember it very well. It was in the old CBS Evening News studios at 524 West 57th Street. I was a little nervous, but the two things I kept saying to myself, and I do remember saying these things to myself, one was a version of I can do it, and I've spent nearly my whole adult life, you know, preparing to do this. And the other was, don't take yourself seriously, take your work seriously. I already knew that being named to succeed Walter Cronkite would put me in a position of, frankly, inhaling every day a kind of NASA-grade rocket fuel for the ego. And that could be dangerous.
Yeah, that sounds pretty dangerous. It also sounds like a little bit lonely.
They say it's lonely at the top. I want to keep this in perspective, that I've never considered myself, you know, a lonely person. I don't suffer from great loneliness, and I didn't then. But there certainly is a sense that you're it. It wasn't a dual anchor.
Mm-hmm.
It was one person. And it was always the great weight. I couldn't complain about it because I knew going in. But just stop and think, you know, trying to succeed Walter Cronkite. I mean, close friends of mine urged me not to take the job because they said, listen, nobody can succeed a Walter Cronkite. The first person who tries to do it is bound to fail. It'll be the second person that comes along. That's just the way life is, Dan.
Hmm.
And there was this sense, I had a lot of help, I had a lot of friends, I thought I was generally well thought of at CBS. But in the end, when the red light goes on, it's just you. In the end, you're by yourself.
You're by yourself, but also you've got to be so many things to so many people in that moment. Was it hard to like hold on to yourself in that job?
Frankly and candidly, the answer is yes. And the longer you're in that role, the more difficult it is to stay true to yourself and to remember who you are and who you want to be, particularly as opposed to who a lot of other people want you to be. One of the many legitimate criticisms that can be made of me is that I try to be a pleaser, that I suffer what Scott Fitzgerald once called the American disease, which is you want everybody to love you. And particularly when you're on television five nights a week, the question of who am I, you should ask it more often. What you wind up asking much more often is, what do they think? I did feel from that first night in 1981, for a good time after that, I did say a version to myself, well, you've always said to yourself, you want to be a pressure player. Here it is. Here's the pressure. So meet the pressure.
I kind of wonder if you feel like both those things can be true at the same time. Like you can both wonder what people are thinking and want to please, and also be present and in the moment and rising to the pressure. Like, can those two things exist at the same time?
Yes, and I'm here to bear witness that they can, because it did with me. It won't always be successful. You know, sometimes the undertow of trying to please puts at risk your ability to meet the pressure. But on other times, you're able to say to yourself, frankly, I don't give a damn what they think. I know what's right, or I know what we need to do. And you move to it. But, you know, Max, a lifetime in journalism has taught me that many people don't understand about journalism as a whole. And that is that journalism is not an exact science. Journalism is more a crude art. Nobody can do it perfectly. No matter how hard you try, no matter how good you are, no matter how great you are, and the Murrows and Cronkites of the world will tell you the same thing, that even on its best days, that you're likely to make some mistakes. And part of being a complete professional at the level we're talking, you learn to accept that on most days, I attempt to say almost every day, you'll fall short of doing it perfectly.
Yeah, you know, I'm in a way, I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And I think that that's true. But I also think that that idea is in like direct tension with the experience of the CBS Evening News while you were anchoring that show. And really like what you were expected to do, which was to be, if not perfect, then definitive.
That's true. I'd agree with that.
And that idea, the thing you're talking about, that journalism's a crude art, that it can't be perfected, that it's not a science. And yet everything from the aesthetics of that show to the tone to the way that you delivered the news, at least my impression is that it was designed to feel that way.
It was and is designed to feel that way.
But did that make you feel totally insane?
Not totally.
Just a little bit?
Maybe a little bit.
It seems really hard to me.
It is hard. But I tell you, for me, in the time I worked at CBS News, which is a total of 44 years, what kept you from losing your balance in this area, in the context of what we're now talking about, was this. At CBS News, one was always very aware of the history and heritage. And the sense of it was that it was recalling. I know some people will laugh at that, but created this feeling for those of us on the inside that CBS News was a magical, mystical kingdom in which every correspondent was expected to be a knight, that in our dreams we had knelt and the blade had been placed on his shoulder. You're a CBS News correspondent. Don't forget that world of Murrow, Severide, Cronkite, long history. So the magical, mystical kingdom was populated by knights who every day and every way tried to do and report on truth, justice in the American way. And that every man and woman at CBS News, from the person who cleaned up the dishes in the cafeteria right up on through the ranks, was part of that. Now, it wasn't true. It may sound strange to anybody on the outside, but for those of us on the inside, it was a great part of what kept us going.
No, it doesn't sound strange. I think lots of people have been connected to one institution or another that's able to define that mystique for itself. But it's jarring when you realize that, you know, Santa Claus isn't real.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? When did you realize that that mystique, because I can hear it in your voice even, that there was value in the mystique and that it meant something to you and it still does. But when did you realize that it wasn't true?
Well, to be perfectly truthful with you, which I try to be, I believed it to the end. In many ways, I still believe it. I don't want to overstate this, but, and I'll probably foul this up in some ways, but some, I think, Irish poet said something along the lines about the church. He said, give me a child until the child is 6 or 7 years old. And if you give me the child for that period, then there will always be a string to his heart that can be plucked. And that was the way it was with CBS News with me. It was the day that I walked out of there. And it has been, as I say, in some ways ever since. The closest I came to what you're talking about, that is a realization that, well, the mystique is one thing, but the reality is another, is after the company had been sold and resold, things began to change. And the pressure had become so great to produce ever-increasing ratings for ever-increasing profits. But you can fault me if you must or choose to, and I wouldn't blame you. I never stopped believing. And I repeat for emphasis, I was a believer the day I walked out. I didn't believe until the last second I was actually going to leave. To put it bluntly, I was forced to leave.
And did that change the mystique, being forced to leave?
Well, it knocked a dent in it.
Yeah.
But I'm not trying to be cute here, because I know myself that the mystique was so deeply ingrained in me. I just thought to the end, something would happen. I'll be at CBS News. I obviously would be in a considerably reduced position, but I want to stay. But when I'm told, get yourself out of the office, get yourself out of here, I had to take a deep breath and say, well, yeah, I still believe in the heritage, the history, and the mystique, but maybe not quite as forcefully as I once did.
The way you're describing it is, it's almost like a kind of faith.
I think that's fair. That's fair. It was a kind of faith. It had an inner spirit for so many years. There were all kinds of sort of codes inside of codes. For example, for years, if you were a correspondent and sent to relieve another correspondent, you had to touch the hand rule. For example, when I went to cover the India-Pakistan War of 1965, I was sent to relieve another legendary CBS News correspondent, Winston Burdett, and I was to relieve him on the western part of India where the war with Pakistan was going on. He couldn't leave the battlefield until I arrived and literally touched his hand. Then that was a signal, okay, it's mine from here on in. And just small rituals like that were deeply ingrained.
The connection that you had to the place, what it meant to you, despite knowing on some level that it couldn't all be true, and despite it taking its various dents, do you think that it's connected in some way to optimism, to believing the best possible version of things is possible. Does that sound right to you? That
yes, it does sound right to me. And frankly, I think that's a very perceptive question. I know enough about myself that I'm an optimist by nature and by experience. I like to think that the longer I've gone in life, that I've become more of an optimistic realist. But I'm an optimist. It's just within me. I know that about myself. And I also know that you can love a thing too much, something like a job, something like an organization, a CBS News, because if you love it too much, you get blinded to its shortcomings. And also, you fail to see the flaws. And I think it's a legitimate criticism of me that in terms of CBS News, that I came to love it too much. I wasn't realistic about some things, including myself and my own role. I made my mistakes. I didn't always handle them well. Don't misunderstand me when I emphasize that over the years I made mistakes. Some of those mistakes were born of arrogance. But about with CBS, as the saying goes, I didn't leave anything on the table.
Yeah.
I gave it everything. I gave it the best I had. Now, in the end, if my best was not good enough, there you are.
The mistakes of arrogance, the mistakes that come from, what was the thing you said? Like a jet fuel hose of ego?
Yeah, I said NASA grade.
Right. NASA grade. Do you think about those moments? Do you regret them now?
Not very often, to tell you the truth. But about that, I'm at peace with myself. But from time to time, I do, mostly in the larger context of saying, well, how lucky I am to have lived this long and to have had my health to live this long, and that I've had time to learn from my mistakes and correct some of my mistakes. And I don't like admitting this, and my wife Jean reminds me sometimes, Dan, just because you know it's true, you don't always have to publicly admit it. You just begin to think that if not the whole world, a lot of the world just revolves around you. And looking back on it, you find yourself talking about yourself much more than you should, of thinking about yourself first, and you kind of convince yourself that your press clippings and your ratings are true. And I went through a period in which my wife, Jean, I'm sorry, you don't know Jean. We've been married 63 years now. She's not given to this kind of language, and she would be embarrassed. But several times, she took me aside and said, Dan, you are becoming a version of the sun-powered, perpetual motion, all-American bullshit machine. And you don't even realize it. When your wife takes you aside and does you the favor of saying something along those lines to you, then you know you need to reassess.
Yeah. On some level, that's all we can ask of our partners, though, you know, to tell us if we're turning into an asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny, though, you know, it's that thing you said about thinking that the world revolves around you and talking too much about yourself and thinking too much about yourself. I think almost everyone falls prey to that pretty often, actually. At least like in your defense, you had a camera pointed at you five nights a week, you know? You actually were the star of your own movie.
Well, that's true to a degree. But in that role, what's called for is gratitude and humility and appreciation, not egocentricity.
I think that wasn't what I expected you to say, but it makes sense to me.
Well, if it makes sense to you, it's probably one of the few sensible things I've said during this hour.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. I hate to break it to you, but you've said a lot of things that make a lot of sense to me, and a lot of things that are surprising. There's another surprising part of your life, Dan, that I feel like we should talk about, which is where you are now in public life. And my sense from the outside, just watching Twitter and Facebook, is that your voice has changed since you left CBS. And I don't know whether it's more political or fuller or more you, but it feels different to me than the person I grew up watching on the evening news. Does it feel different to you?
Yes, it does feel that way to me. And I say that with a smile. We're on radio, so you can't see the smile. I say that with a smile. I don't have a responsibility to that history and mystique of CBS News we talked about, nor do I have any loyalty to any corporation or any other person. I've just been on my own. What I've been through in these most recent years and up to and including this time, I've felt as good about it as I have about anything I've done in my career. I know there'll be voices that say, well, that's not much. That's damning with faint praise, but nonetheless, that I really do think I've done some of the best work of my career since leaving CBS, and I feel very good about that. The biggest difference is being on one's own. No one to answer to except yourself and to the audience. And I've always wanted to have courage. I've never considered myself a particularly courageous person, but I've always wanted to have courage. And it may be, I hope it's true, and I actually think it is true. I may be closer to having courage now. I may be closer to having some guts, if you will, now, than I ever was when I was at CBS.
What do you mean by that, Dan?
Well, it stands on its own. An example would be if some politician consistently lies, then one should call that a lie. Hmm. Now, I don't say I was the first, but I was among the first that 4 or 5 years ago, when it became obvious that certain candidates, one in particular, was telling a lie after lie after lie. No question about it being a lie. I was among those who said, we should call it a lie. Let's call it what it is. And more recently, in referring to efforts to limit how people vote, opportunities, chances for people to vote are limited, I suggested we should call it what it is, which is Jim Crow. It's designed to limit the voting voice, primarily of minority groups. So in that sort of thing, I wouldn't classify it as courage or even guts, but it comes closer.
Courage is also about taking risks, right? Like, did saying those things feel risky in a way that felt new for you?
Now, there's no net. This is another mixed metaphor, but when you work at a place like CBS News, there are all kinds of safety nets. There are other people you work with, there are editors, there are bosses. When you're doing what I do now, you're aware that you're working without a net. Mm-hmm. You can say, I'm an experienced highway walker, and I have confidence that I can do it. Look, and I've always said the mission of the journalist is to get to the truth or as close to the truth as is humanly possible. And I have a sense that I'm closer to doing that on a daily basis now. I'm at least as close as I've ever been in my career.
Do you think that that's something that you can just have that's attainable? Or is that just a thing that comes and goes?
Well, if you're lucky, it comes and goes. But for some people, it never comes.
Never arrives, yeah. Right.
For some people, it never comes. No, it's an aspiration. Sometimes you can mount courage or as close to courage as you're capable of doing. And other times, you don't do it. Afterward, you say to yourself, I know that I flinched, I blinked, I walked away. But if you're lucky and have God's grace, you live another day, and somewhere along the line, you'll be tested again.
And are you able to have grace with yourself in those moments?
Well, as close as one is likely to have, yes. But it hasn't always been true. I'm a better person now than I was. I'm a better pro now than I was. But I don't say that in the sense that I look back and say to myself, oh, why didn't I do this when I was 25 or 35 or 50? It's just the arc of life. I can be dumb as a fence post about a lot of things, but I'm at least smart enough to know that now I'm on the backside of the mountain. And I've come to think I better spend as much of my energy and time as I can of seeing every day as a gift, rather worrying about things I didn't do or should have done or could have done when I was on the upside of the mountain rather than here on the shadowy side.
That seems like a good way to be.
It feels that way too.
We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gabriella Saldivia put that episode together. Susan Peterson did the show notes. Thanks to them. Thanks to the entire 70 Over 70 team at Pineapple Street Studios. That's Jess Hackle, Janelle Anderson, Charlie Locke, Maddie Sprung-Kaiser, Joel Lovell, and Jenna Weiss-Berman. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp. And thanks so much to Dan Rather. If you enjoyed that conversation, go check out 70 Over 70. It's my new show. There's a couple episodes up already. Dionne Warwick, Norman Lear, Andre DeShields, Sister Helen Prejean, and we'll have a lot more coming throughout the summer. You can find it wherever you are listening to this show, which will be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.